Guys, welcome to another episode of Film Class Zeros. I'm Rich, and with me as always is Alex. What's going on, dude?
It has begun, Rich.
What does that mean? Does that mean we're going to talk about Mortal Kombat from 1995 today?
That's exactly what it means. It has begun both in the film and in the podcast sense. We are kicking this off with this classic movie of cartoonish characters not really killing themselves or each other as they're supposed to.
It is a it is a classic movie. I do consider this a classic. I know it's not Citizen Kane. I know it's not Citizen Cage, but it is definitely a classic. I love this movie, dude. Like, this is such a great flick. I saw this in the theater when I was a kid, and I've had like an on and off obsession with it ever since.
All right. Well, if you don't know what this movie is, we will bring you up to speed. Basically, it is based off of a very famous video game franchise. The movie itself is summarized like this. The protector of Earthrealm, Lord Raiden, gathers fighters to compete in Mortal Kombat, an ancient mystical tournament in place to protect the world from extra-dimensional invasion. Earth's warriors must win Mortal Kombat and defeat the sorcerer Shang Tsung, or Earth is doomed.
Pretty heavy stakes there.
Yeah, you wouldn't get that sense if you watched the movie. It doesn't feel that heavy.
You know what? You're right. Like, the stakes are very heavy, but the action's awesome. I shouldn't say action. I think action's the wrong word. The stakes are very heavy, but it also kind of, there's kind of like a let's just do some cool stuff and try to save the day kind of attitude going on.
You know what I've noticed is that, like, movies like this where they're action packed. There's action in this, but getting everything between the action is very like loose and sort of like, like sort of meandering. There's never like real. There's not like there's a kinetic connection between. It's sort of like action, 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 and then sort of, you know, hanging out on a boat or like looking off into the sunset.
A lot of quirky one-liners too. Now, you know what I find fascinating about this flick is, you know, this came along really not too far after the video game franchise came along. And I think the reason why is because the game was such a hallmark of violence in video games. It was like one of the first games to use digitized folks. Like, they were actual actors and martial artists that were digitized and put in the fighting game. And it was for the time, it was the bloodiest thing on the planet. But looking back on it now, it's no more than a nosebleed. I think Hollywood was like, we got to turn this into a movie somehow, and we got to make it better than Mario Brothers.
I definitely bought the game because on the back of the package, it said digitized folks.
It said folks.
It said digitized folks. It was advertised. I was like, yeah, let me get into that digitized folk action. Mm-hmm. No, I know what you mean. Like, it's certainly a hallmark. I think it raised the cackles of a lot of people because it was a level of violence. It was that digitization of actors and performers that highlighted, that made this a cartoony violence, maybe more. It crossed for them, I guess, that line into past the cartoon part and more into the reality part, or it sort of resonated. It wasn't just like some digital, sprite being recreated and then all this stuff happening. So it looked like it was happening to people. And it really wasn't, you know, for the time it was pretty eye opening. So yeah. But I feel like that is sort of a very small part of the larger Mortal Kombat picture personally. I mean, I could talk about these video games all day.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of what I think is really cool. And, you know, I watched the new Mortal Kombat flick and I loved it. Right. And in watching it, you know, my brother and I and my wife watched it together, and my brother and I, huge video game fans, huge Mortal Kombat fans. We were explaining to my wife was like, how do you know so much about these video game characters? You know? And I was like, well, when we were kids and these games came out, you know, you had like your video game magazines that came out monthly. And in those magazines, not only would you have interviews with the creators of Mortal Kombat, you would get the moveset of everybody, and you'd get like pages and pages of story and bio for characters that just appeared out of nowhere. And I think that lore and myth is built into this flick, the 1995 flick, from the get-go.
I think the lore, you're right, absolutely. And I think the lore is what makes this and the games it's what's made them endure, because yeah. they are, there's so much to dive into, you know, like now we're in an era where we have in connected universes, they're sort of par for the course in all sorts of media. And I feel like Mortal Kombat was one of those sort of, I want to say pioneers, but they were definitely doing that in a big way, you know, like, yeah. cause you had the character bios in the game, mm-hmm. during the character select screens, and then all the moments in between. We had the magazines, like you said, you had like the player guides and the fighting guides and all this other stuff. And that was a big, it was a critical part in the game, because it also was a big reason why you picked one of the guys or, you know, one of the characters or not, you know, they had like the guys who looked cool and had a cool moveset, but then you're like, all right, well, I'm going to align with this guy because he's part of this, like the Lin Kuei clan, and they're going to fight like the White Lotus. And, mm-hmm. and then you start, it's, you know, it's like a sports team, and you're going to be like, well, I'm on team Lin Kuei because this is my dude. And you would say like, right. this is my dude, this is my guy, you know, this is my main.
They don't hesitate to jump in to your very solid character introductions in this flick, you know, and I do feel like that kind of in your face storytelling is missing from a lot of like current action flicks, you know, where like there's clear lines where you're like, good guy, bad guy. Here's my explanation for this. You know, like Shang Tsung is a good example, right? Like Shang Tsung's clearly the bad guy. And he basically says, hey, this is Scorpion. This is Sub-Zero. They're mortal enemies, but guess what? I'm mind controlling them. So you're fucked.
Surprisingly, the movie does a really good job of connecting all of these threads, even if they're mm-hmm. like super thin, you know, stringy connections. There's I've seen this movie, I don't even know how many times, but even for this, I did yet another rewatch, and I was catching connections because mm-hmm. there are things that you want to not pick apart, but it you feel like, oh, they didn't really explain this. But then you'll find, if you're paying attention to the parts in between the fights, mm-hmm. that they'll make the connection. You go, well, at least like, yeah, they'll look, it's they're explaining something away, but they are at least explaining it. And you kind of give it to it, because the point is to not, you know, tell this huge story. It's like, we're trying to get to this cool stuff, and you know that we're trying to get to this cool stuff. So even if it's just like one step between here and there, the step is there.
That's an interesting point to make too, because like the story in and of itself is a grand story when you really think about it, you know, but for the purposes of getting to the action and the wacky characters, it's very rushed in this format, you know, like about an hour and a half. And it works, you know what? It works. Even Christopher Lambert's Raiden with his wacky accent, it works.
Long Island's own Christopher Lambert.
Long Island's own Christopher Lambert. But, you know, like take us through like, not the premise, obviously, because we already said that. But, you know, like the whole, what's the gist of the flick right here?
So what kicks off is we have this tournament that's being set up. I was going to say Emperor, the Sorcerer, Shang Tsung. Mm-hmm. There is an Emperor. Everyone has shifting titles. Mm-hmm. Shang Tsung and Raiden are moving pieces around the board for this thing. You know, they're playing a greater game. And three of the biggest pieces that we focus on, our protagonists, are Liu Kang, a Shaolin monk who's living in the States, Johnny Cage, an action star, and Sonya Blade. I don't think they ever say Blade, but Sonya Blade, mm-hmm. A special forces operative who gets, like everyone else, kind of roped in, but even her attachment to everything is sort of a loose connection. And then they are chosen, which we'll talk about because I did air quotes, to fight in Mortal Kombat. And the tournament is set up because there are these realms, Earth Realm and Outworld, and there are other realms, but for the sake of this is what we're going to focus on. And the tournament is there to prevent realms from just invading and taking over. So mm-hmm. obviously Earth Realm, we're not in any position to attack Outworld because, you know, it's a secret thing. Outworld, I feel like everyone there knows about all the realms. Here it's our normal world, and the tournament is there to protect the conquerors and the emperors of Outworld to come over here. They have to win 10 in a row. They've won 9 and we're on 10, so these three people have to basically be the combo breaker, which is from a different game, and it's all like on their shoulders again, like NBD.
Right, right. Again, like this movie, like you could take this concept and easily make, like, you can do a Peter Jackson thing and make 3 4-hour long movies introduce every single character in the mythos and have your last flick just be the big battle between Outworld and Earthrealm.
You, if they made this movie, or they did make this movie today, but if they remade this movie, you know, in the style that you're talking about, there is enough there to draw on to make big trilogy, make a prequel trilogy, because there are 9 tournaments,
right,
at the very least, that were, I'm sure, interesting stories, because this happened 9 times. And I'm trying to think, I'm not a big sports guy, but I'm sure that you might know in your head some sort of reference where there's a team that had like a 9 season losing streak and then had to really pull it together in their 10th year.
Well, you know, like I'm not Johnny American football over here, but I do know that I'll take the Cubs, for example. Like, the Cubs never won a World Series until like, you know, like a few years ago. You know, like, you kind of really, that's a good sports analogy to kind of, this needs to happen, you know, like this is the quote unquote last dance, and we need to really, really win this one for literally the home team, which is Earth. I do agree with you. You could give it like the Hobbit treatment. Like, the Hobbit was like, you can read the Hobbit in like a day, right? I don't think 3 movies that were like 4 hours each is very necessary, but you could do that, I think, easier with Mortal Kombat. And they kind of, in the new Mortal Kombat flick, the one that just came out, they gave little nods to that stuff where like the other champions of Earth and like other characters were there from like the past, like Nightwolf was shown at one point, Kotal Kahn was shown at one point, you know, which is for the fans, but there's really something there. I think, you know, I think it's just up to a studio to really take the leap, or somebody with a lot of stroke to take a leap and say, you know what? I really want it. Like Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah.
I want to make 3 Mortal Kombat. I want to do a Mortal Kombat trilogy, and let's see where it goes, you know, and have big name actors play these guys along with like infamous martial artists, you know.
I'm now picturing Christopher Lambert as Raiden. Said it in like in a fancy way. I'm picturing him as like the coach of like the Chicago Cubs, going like, listen guys, we've lost 9 like we've lost 9 seasons in a row. If we don't win this 10th season, the other team gets to keep Wrigley Field.
Exactly. If baseball worked like that, absolutely. That's a good metaphor.
Or I would watch.
Or like soccer. You know, I think soccer may be better applied. Like, we need to, or something. I don't know. I don't know what I'm talking about anymore. but, you know, like, so like the movie looks great. You know, it holds up in a very weird way.
Mm-hmm. I think it does look good. I think a lot of the look of the movie is sort of, it's a mix, because I feel like they do a lot of really good shot composition, but I feel that a lot of it is, you know, it's scenes and tableaus and a lot of still imagery. And the you know, we are so used to, you know, films now where everything is lived in and very much explained. And a lot of these shots are set up for the sake of setting up a shot. Yeah. You know, like you have the introduction of Liu Kang, where he's in his room. We see it just once and it's fine. It's not super important. But like, what are we told about him? He lives in a very weird industrial apartment that has like cement walls, and he has a bike, and he has a basketball, and several cameras, and like, what are we supposed to learn about Liu Kang in this? Doesn't tell us really anything.
He's a squatter.
And even like, yeah, well, yeah, he lives in storage, and you know, it's colored and lit in a very like bright green overlay, you know, and this happens a lot in the movie, where the scenes have a very specific temperature and is and color grading. Not even so much color grading, just color lighting.
Mm-hmm.
Very specific to all the scenes. Some places are, you know, cooler and blue, and they always mix a lot of colors and a lot of color mixing with the lighting, which is really interesting. Like purple with orange on one side of someone's face, and then, you know, like a lit brazier, but it's still with blue beams of light coming in a room. And that's fun. That's part of the I think the look and the charm of the movie, where everything is very deliberate and bright and colorful.
It works though. I mean, that's the look. When you look at this movie, you're like, that's what Mortal Kombat looks like.
No, yeah, 100%. And you know, that's I think part of the influence of the game. So to go back to what you were saying before about Hollywood trying to like get in on the action, essentially, I feel like this is that time where Hollywood is always trying to find things to adapt. And this is one of those pop culture video games, is that realm of pop culture where I think was sort of untouched for a bit. You know, like I think they tried the Mario Brothers movie, video games in general, wasn't as mainstream and part of and like connected to everything as you know things are now. So it was sort of like a niche thing. If it was not just like a child's thing with Mortal Kombat, a very mature experience, it was still sort of untapped. And the rules of how to adapt things like this haven't really been worked out. And I feel like it's the same thing with comics too, because surely after that, we try to get like the Spawn movie just a couple of years after that. And it feels almost like the same attempt in a way, as far as like the technology not really being there, the budget not really being substantial enough to bring to life these characters and so on.
Well, I think you made a really good point, especially with the Spawn thing. You know, it feels like this, the 90s era of CG was very interesting because it wasn't so much, hey, this is what we can do and it's going to look awesome. It was more, check out what we can do. This shit looks like a computer, you know, with like parts of Scorpion Spear, the way Reptile looks. It was good enough for the time. And the same thing with Spawn, you know, like a lot of the stuff in Spawn just looks really hokey and it doesn't hold up. I don't think they were thinking we need to make this hold up, you know, like in Indiana Jones, right? Like you watch Raiders, that movie holds up completely. But again, that's also like Spielberg, you know, there's so many effects in that movie and they all look good. They all hold up very, very well. Mortal Kombat, you know, it was, again, that 90s style of filmmaking where it's like the kids are going to love this, you know, like that kind of thing where it's like it's almost like a throwaway. And when you watch it now, I still really dig this movie, but there are certain effects in it that are just like, oof, I wonder why they did that. But the contrast to that is I'm glad they went full practical effects with Goro.
Yeah. That's an interesting choice. And you're right. And I feel like it's funny because like looking back, it's sort of like almost like a no-brainer, because I don't want to talk too much about the remake that just came out. I feel like that's a good example of what they probably wanted to do, but were limited because in the new one, it's a big CG character and there's like a great action sequence and Goro can do just run rampant on the set and in the scene. And it looks, you know, flawless. It looks like he's fighting a giant monster. He has all the freedom to do things. In this movie, it's a practical effect. It's a big animatronic on the shoulder of someone. I don't even think that it occurred to them to do the CG version of him, because I think it was like prohibitively expensive. I think the technology, even if they had the money, wouldn't look convincing at all. So I'm with you. And I feel like later when we talk about that, like it's one of those things where the fight could be a lot more, but sort of suffers by the technological limitations of the time and the budgetary constraints of this movie, which, you know, like no one's going to throw in that kind of movie to make something that fantastical, that convincing for something like this.
Yeah, I think it took a while for Hollywood to catch up with that idea in general. Like, hey, if we're going to make something, like we got to make it look really good. I think I want to say like Sam Raimi's Spider-Man was really the first action superhero property like genre flick that really nailed that. You know, like, yo, this has to look great. Even like X-Men 2000, like they just put everybody in a leather suit. And Blade too. They just threw him in like a leather outfit, you know, and it worked. But to get those like move those comic book / video game accurate outfits, like very like authentic, is tough. I think this flick does a decent enough job of it so that you're not bothered by it. You know, like I thought Scorpion and Sub-Zero looked great. Johnny Cage is really not much to do with him. You know, like he just has to really, like the video game character just wears like pants and sunglasses, right? You know, same thing with Liu Kang, pants, red belt, Sonya, bodysuit, you know? So like, it's kind of, it's oddly, the characters for the most part are oddly based in the real world, but then you have a Reptile and a Goro and a Shang Tsung and a Raiden like thrown in there. And Kano looked great in this, I think.
Kano looked fantastic. And I think to your point that may be intentional or otherwise, it set up the differences between Earthrealm and Outworld and all these fantastical characters that come from, that are literally from another dimension, that are literally, you know, otherworldly. But and I want to say something that you, based on what you said, that I thought was super interesting, that Hollywood sort of moving the bar closer and, you know, moving things further down the line with superhero movies and properties like this. Blade's a great example. I think X-Men's a great example, where it's like trying to make these things grounded in some sort of reality. And I feel like, yeah, Spider-Man's a great example of definitely like a benchmark of bringing that to life. I think a lot of things are compared to that. I feel like, you know, the Superman, the original Superman movies, that's like, you know, I feel like that might have been like the real first sort of genesis of that, where it's like, you will believe a man can fly. He's wearing a comic, you know, accurate costume. And even though like, it's still, you know, that's a great thing about like, we were so lucky to have Christopher Reeve be in that role, because it would otherwise look hokey, even in retrospect. But now we're watching this old movie, and it's still, you know, he commands like a respect, and he looks great in this very tight fitting costume, where, you know, if, and again, I think that that's something that when they try to remake those movies, they said, well, we have to make the costume look more quote unquote real, and not just, you know, pajamas, essentially. So everything has texture and all these different layers and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And when it comes to this movie, I feel like they did a really good job of like splitting the difference, because they look like very good versions of the outfits that were in the game. And Kano is a great example, where he's like a guy, but the face part, the mechanical eye looks really comic accurate. And I'm like, that's what you came to see.
Yeah. Yeah. Like they did a really, like you said, I like what you mentioned. They split the difference with all that stuff. You know, like, it may not have been the biggest budgeted flick in general, but I think they did a good job of putting the money where they needed to, you know. At some point, you know, like in the second act of the flick, you're starting to get more of the fights, which I think is what people want to see.
Absolutely.
You know, and go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that, like, the movie, when we get to this point, I feel like the movie has, when we were talking about they rush things, I feel like they were really good to move things along in the sense that, like, we have this tournament, these two beings are influencing our lead characters, and I feel like they make their motivations really clear. So, like, Liu Kang, right off the bat, Shang Tsung is kills his brother, and he gets a vision about it, and he goes back to China to declare. They let on that he knows what's going on. He's the only one that's sort of in the know. Everyone else is sort of being clueless. Even though he doesn't believe it, he still knows the legends of Lord Raiden and all this other stuff. He's there to avenge his brother. Johnny Cage is an action star. He's the real deal. He's a fighter, and he wants to prove that he's not a phony. So he gets manipulated into joining this. And then Sonya's there to basically catch Kano. And she is the most manipulated, in the sense that she doesn't really have anything to prove. She has one specific thing, and she's being sort of like led with a carrot on a stick to the tournament because they want her to be in the tournament.
I think that's interesting, because they almost kind of did the same thing in this flick too, in the remake also. You know, they kind of kept Sonya like almost like that status quo character. The thing I find interesting about this movie is watching it again and again and again, is I feel like I would have a very different reaction if I saw any of this shit happen.
Like, well, give me an example.
You know, like, if I saw like a dude freeze another dude, I'd be like, I'd lose my mind, I think. You know, like, if you really saw Goro in front of you, or if you saw Kano's one thing, because you could be like, oh, he's got like a weird thing in his head, you know, like, oh, that looks uncomfortable. But Scorpion shooting a spear out of his hand, Sub-Zero freezing people, Goro, and then Raiden showing up is a dude with lightning powers, you know. My first question to Raiden would be like, why aren't you doing stuff?
Yeah, they sort of touched on that a little bit, because they sort of quickly like yada yada this away, where Liu Kang goes and he's like, I'm going to fight Shang Tsung to avenge my brother. And then Raiden is like, oh, no, he says, why didn't you protect if you're the protector of Earthrealm, if you're real, why didn't you protect my brother? And he's like, why didn't you? And then they're like, oh, enough of this. And they sort of it's their way of like asking the question and then not answering it, just to move on. And again, this is the thing where it's like, you have to pay almost too much attention to this stuff for a movie like this, where later Raiden says, you know, he asks, he's like, why these three people? And he basically says, I've looked into your souls, and you're the people that have that weird X factor, not in so many words, but you three have the X factor that makes all the difference. And you're going to be one of you is going to be the winner, or the person that we're going to count on to win this, you know. So it's like, okay, well, it's not maybe the most satisfactory explanation, but one, I don't need everything spelled out. And two, at least we got like some sort of reason as to why they are the focal point and why this boat full of people are basically, want to be brutal about it, lambs to the slaughter.
Yeah.
And that's why I feel bad about Art Lee. He's our POV character. He's the one who's like, he's a really nice guy. Uh-huh. And he's like amazed by everything. He's like, this is great. And he's like, I'm going to a tournament. And you guys, I liked your movie and you're the real deal. And like, everyone loves art. Art's going to be fine.
Oh, no, definitely not. Art gets pretty messed up. I think he gets the most messed up.
Yeah. And it really sucks, too, because like he's the one who's watching. He's the one having the reactions that you're talking about where, you know, these monsters and all these supernatural things are happening and everyone else is like taking a fighting pose. And Art Lee is like wide eyed going like, what? This is crazy.
It's very funny. You know, like I obviously like you need your heroes to be heroes, but I think like it's very interesting how everybody was directed in this flick, you know, and they're like immediately a team. They immediately assess the threat. They hold their ground. They're not upset by all these monsters that they're fighting. And you know what? You know what? I got to say, they did a shitty job because they let Art Lee die.
Yeah, I feel like. You're saying like they did a shitty job or the movie did a shitty job?
No. Like Liu Kang, Sonya, oh, them. Yeah. Like that, like Johnny Cage, all the good guys, Raiden's especially, you know, like they let this poor dude who just seemed like a happy-go-lucky guy die. You have in the notes that he is the heart of the flick.
Well, because everyone is like, everyone dotes on him. And in the movie where like everyone is very sarcastic to each other and they have a almost... they have a sarcastic bond and a tenuous sort of connection to each other where it's like begrudging. So that's a begrudging connection. Mm-hmm. Everyone immediately likes Art and Art is like super nice.
Yeah.
You know, when these soldiers who come in and they have like the weird, like like the tube sock masks on their head and they start flipping tables and like Art's eating. And you're like, oh man, let him finish his food. Like he's cool. He's just hanging out. But then I think also that's also the thing that gets Johnny Cage to sort of step up in the sense that he realizes that they, as you said, they let Art down.
I think that's when the stakes get like not higher, but like more evident is when it seems like they let Art down, you know, and like, let's not just do it for Earth. Let's do it for Art, you know, almost
art.
Like,
I was going to say art for art's sake.
Art for art's sake.
Martial arts.
There you go. Martial art. They should have called him martial art.
Martial Art Lee.
In this, when we're talking about it in that regard, it reminds me of the first Avengers movie where it took Coulson dying for the Avengers to be like, you know what, let's do this.
Yeah, but then we got like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. So I'm still waiting for my Art Lee spinoff. Like, why didn't they should have put him in one of the games at this point.
Maybe he's in the background. Oh. You want to talk about the fights?
Yeah, let's do it.
So you got Liu Kang versus Sub-Zero. Listen, I think as far as your CG goes, you're not going to get a full-blown crazy-ass Sub-Zero moment. But Liu Kang is great. Robin Shao, he's the dude.
He's great, and his hair is amazing.
Best hair in the business, man. I kind of wish they had him in the remake, too, because I feel like that guy would have been fantastic. Liu Kang's dad or something.
Yeah, that would have been he's so underutilized. He was then and he is now, especially now where everything is sort of like coming back around because it has this nostalgia factor. Even the most recent games brought Cary Tagawa back to be Shang Tsung in the game. And I think they even brought Bridget Wilson to voice Sonya for certain things. And Christopher Lambert. So keep saying Lambert. Is it Lambert or Lambert?
It's Lambert.
It's Lambert. Okay, yeah, so I'm saying Lambert. It right. Okay,
you're not saying it right. It's Lambert. Christopher Lambert.
See, he's from Great Neck, and I don't live in Great Neck, so I should explain that joke. His Wikipedia. He was born in Great Neck, New York, on Long Island, and then moved to France and things like that. But I think it's just kind of fun to say like the voice that he's putting on is a very Great Neck, Long Island accent.
That's how everybody talks in Great Neck.
Yeah. Hello, Alex. Welcome to Great Neck.
So you had your Liu Kang versus Sub-Zero, Sonya versus Kano. I think this was a good setup for Sonya. Like it was a bit of a weak fight, but it was also kind of satisfying, you know, because she catches the bad guy.
Yeah, it goes back to like the motivation. So, you know, Liu Kang has this whole, you know, that Liu Kang is going to be the guy that goes to the end. And you know, whatever happens to Johnny Cage is part of that sort of journey. And then her thing, she gets pulled into the tournament because she's one of the chosen or whatever. And her whole thing is she wants to get Kano because he killed her partner, and she's just hell bent on revenge. So she gets there, and then her first fight is with him, and she kills him, and it's done. And so she's sort of done. Like she's finished. She's just now just hanging out for a bit, you know? Like, it's, yeah. So it's just sort of like, okay, well, I guess her movie's done, and she's just kind of, she's like, I wrapped up my business, but I'm going to hang out. You guys do your thing.
Which is cool. You know, like, she didn't have to do that. She did what she set out to do. You know, she's doing it for art. Johnny Cage versus Scorpion. I love this fight specifically. I love the end of the fight. This fight took it to the next level.
Yeah, I think this is the fight that we came to see. Because just going back to the Liu Kang and Sub-Zero thing, like, we want to see the stuff from the games being portrayed in the movie. So, like, as accurate as they look in action, I guess, again, it's the limitations of what you have to work with technologically and budget-wise. They got real fighters and performers to pull these sequences off, and it's great, and I love that the practicality of it. But, you know, as much as I want to see Sub-Zero be portrayed as an actual fighting character, I want to see him, you know, throw an ice beam. I want to see him do something. And what they do is, it's this whole elaborate sequence where it's one sort of power move that really kind of, he uses his powers. He does like one sort of move to as a demonstration early in the movie. And then in the fight, he doesn't really do much. Again, like the recent remake has basically, that has the Sub-Zero fight that we always wanted to see, where he is pulling out all the stops and he's using all the special moves.
Oh yeah,
that we, you know, that we want to see. And so, like, that's why I feel like, as weak in that regard as the Sub-Zero fight was, the Scorpion fight is awesome, because he's got the spear hand, he's got the fire face, he's doing teleporting, he's pulling out all the stops. It's fantastic.
It's kind of funny too, because I feel like Cage has Cage has the strongest fights in the flick, you know, like fighting Scorpion, and then his fight with Goro too, which I really appreciate. You know, like, it's like Cage basically accepts like a challenge for the prince, like Prince Goro. They give this guy such like big heraldry. It's awesome, you know, and he looks so intimidating.
He is, and I think that you're right. I feel like he has like some of the better fights, and he has a really good arc in the movie. And he starts off, even though he is sort of proclaiming throughout the flick that I'm the real deal, I want to prove myself, we don't really get to see it. It's all talk, and we get to see him be like a prima donna, where he's carrying bags and he's like a caricature of a Hollywood actor and things like that. And it's in this, you know, these sequences where we get to see him really fight, really put to the test. After Art dies, he starts taking things super serious,
right,
and even says like, I'm going to challenge the big guy, because that doubt is gone, because he's sort of, you know, he doesn't sacrifice himself, but he sort of submits to the possibility that, like, I'm stepping up to this, you know, win or lose, I'm not afraid. I have the confidence to rise to the challenge. And that's the completion of his arc. And he fights Goro. The fight, again, it's like, it's a guy in a costume. They have only so much to work with, because it is this giant, basically a rig sitting on top of someone's shoulders. And it is super imposing in that regard. But then the fight is very, again, like with Sonya, like even the cuts couldn't really like hide all the slow action and the things that you can't actually kick and punch, something like that. But, you know, it resolves Cage's whole thing. He beats the guy. He wins. And he the way that Lyndon Ashby portrays him changes. And it's great. And it's so under commented on, because, you know, we didn't come to see that. We came to see the fights, and he does a great job.
Well, I think not only did we come to see the fights, but I think the movie does such a great job of presenting the fights to you. You know, like, it's not, like, I remember, like, when this movie came out, I was like, how are they going to do this? You know, because in the game, you know, it's a video game. So, like, you go round by round and that's it until you get to the boss. You know, and in the first Mortal Kombat, it was Shang Tsung and Goro. They did the same with the movie, but they're giving you a loose reason for why everything happens, you know? And after Cage beats Goro, you know, Shang Tsung kind of reveals his even truer colors. He manipulates the rules, kidnaps Sonya, and Liu Kang and Johnny Cage go into Outworld to save her. Your first fight in Outworld is Reptile, who's been stalking them the whole time, versus Liu Kang.
Yeah, I think as great as the Scorpion fight is, I think the Liu Kang and Reptile fight is probably my favorite fight in the movie. because it kicks off, it comes out of nowhere. I think everything else before this point is set up in the very, admittedly, very loose tournament style.
Yeah.
Because throughout the movie, between the conversations between Shang Tsung and Raiden, there are these rules that are all being alluded to and used very conveniently whenever they need to do something or not do something. The tournament is the same way, where they are these fights. We have no idea what the tournament structure is. Supposedly you fight to the death, but there are some fights in the movie where you don't fight to the death. And like for instance, with Princess Katana gets introduced earlier in the movie, she fights Liu Kang. They sort of come to a stalemate and they don't obviously kill each other. And it's basically there for him, for her to sort of sneak some information to Liu Kang. And then Shang Tsung is just kind of like annoyed by it. He's like, oh, come on, what is this? And then they leave and nothing happens. So this is the point where they cross into Outworlds. Reptile is Liu Kang catches him. And then he is, you know, up until this point, he's like a really real unconvincing CGI effect that's been chasing him or creeping around. And then he gets thrown into a statue and then he turns into the Green Ninja. And then the fight kicks off. And then, you know, it kicks off with like the reptile announcer from the game just sort of inserted, and then techno music, and they just jump through a wall, and it's now it's like an old school, you know, kung fu flick fight, and it's pumping, and I'm getting jazzed talking about it right now. Like, it's so exciting.
It was one of the better fights in the game, and it's, you know, I really like the way they wrap the terrible CGI scorpion into going into the statue and somehow turning that statue into like the vessel for the Green Ninja.
Mm-hmm. This is the fight where it's like, it's so good that I forget that Reptile also has power moves like spitting acid in his tongue and stuff. It's like,
yeah,
for the other fights, it's like, oh, well, I want to see them use this. This fight is so great, or the actual between the two, you know, the two actors doing this, it's so frenetic and enjoyable that I'm not even thinking about the special moves.
Right. And Outworld looks awesome too.
Outworld looks great. Like, some of the CG effects don't really hold up. When they do a lot of the compositing, I think it looks pretty decent when they're walking around.
Yeah. And we have, like, I think the culmination of, like, the whole movie is based on Liu Kang, right? And Robin Chow did such a tremendous job in this. Like, everybody did such a tremendous job in this. Like, I feel like they all sold it, you know, like they did the best they could with the script that they were given. But Robin Chow versus Liu Kang versus Shang Tsung, this was one of the more enjoyable fights of the flick for me.
Okay, that's interesting, because it wasn't for me. So I want to hear why you liked it so much.
I liked it because it was so hokey, and it kind of reminded me of Big Trouble in Little China, like the end of that movie, you know, and I'm a big fan of that. But there was like a couple of weird back and forth that I didn't appreciate, like the morphing right in front of Liu Kang's eyes and him getting confused, you know, which I thought was a little weird. But for some reason, like, they make it work. And Shang Tsung as a villain, I feel like what I liked was, like, it just seemed like he was kind of grasping at straws at the end of the flick, you know, like, uh-oh, I can't believe we're not going to win 10 in a row.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
So why didn't you like that fight?
I feel like the fight itself was kind of weak. I think, first of all, like, this is a great opportunity to say that Cary Tagawa did an amazing job and made his version of Shang Tsung iconic. The video game one is sort of, he's a very typical, you know, mystical caricature. This version of him, I mean, in every scene that he's in, he's got great face.
Great
face acting.
A lot of face.
Chewing the scenery. Everything is big. Everything is so, like, his sinisterness is just so dripping and like slimy, but with such a, like, pompous confidence, and it's so great. And then when he gets angry, he's just like, his face is just contorting and he's just spitting lines at Liu Kang, and you're like, this is awesome. So, like, the fight itself is sort of weak, but, like, all his reactions where he's getting so frustrated, he's doing a great job. I mean, there's no fault there. I just feel like, as far as the fights are concerned, not the worst fight, but it's also just sort of it's checking off a box. He has to fight him.
Okay. I mean,
you know, but it doesn't do any, like you said, like, he does the morphing thing, but he doesn't really do anything. He doesn't, like, the practical fighting isn't that awesome, and he doesn't throw in any cool effects apart from trying to convince, like you said, like, Liu Kang. He's like, hey, Liu Kang, it's me, your brother. He's like, dude, I just saw you in front of me. Like, I'm not an idiot. You
know? I think also you mentioning Karatagawa's face is the selling point of that fight, where like there could not have been anybody else to play Shang Tsung at all. You know, he is the ultimate Shang Tsung. And again, you brought up the point before, they brought him back. They digitized him again to be Shang Tsung in the last Mortal Kombat, like as a DLC to go along with that game. So you think the movie's over, you think Earthrealm wins. They go back to the temple. They meet Raiden. Raiden basically says, like, I knew you had it in you, which I feel like would piss me off if I was there.
Yeah, well, I think that it sort of goes back to we were talking about how he's treating these really tenuous stakes with a lot of casual sort of apathy and saying, like, oh, no, I have confidence in you. And it's like, did you have confidence in like the last nine dudes? Because I feel like, you know, you're pushing it here with being this sort of confident.
I think Raiden is, I'm going to try to make like a succinct point here. I feel like Raiden is very much like a Gandalf, in which he has these powers, but doesn't really do anything with them. You know, like he's this magnificent being, but he's still subject to the whims of the reality he's in. You know, maybe that's my excuse for not really seeing any cool Raiden shit, you know?
Yeah, that sounds pretty on the nose. I think a lot of that sort of is demonstrated by, you know, him sort of sparking up every once in a while, but then saying like, you know, I know my dominion and my place and all these other things about these rules that get tossed around, where he's bound by certain things, but they're unexplained to us and mysterious.
Right. And, you know, like I do like the end of the flick, though. Like the end of the flick sets you up for that sequel, that little tease for Mortal Kombat 2, where I think it's Shao Kahn bursting through the top of the temple, or appearing at the top of the temple, and then everybody going into their fighting pose and saying like, whatever's going to come next, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm flipped on that, because I feel like, yeah, how do you end this movie? You have to tease the sequel. You have to, everything is like a big celebration at the end. And so they're all like high-fiving each other. Then this image of the emperor bursts out. He's like, I am Shang Tsung. I've come to steal your soul. It's like, I don't think so. Bam. Action pose, freeze frame.
Yeah,
and it's so hokey, but it's sort of just like end the movie, just hit the movie, you know, hitting the end button, the end.
Like, you know what's funny about
when you're writing it, I'm sorry to cut you off, but it's just writing it, it's like, and then they stop fighting, the end.
They look at him and the end. Yeah. You know, it's a good way to, I remember seeing in a theater and being like, oh shit, I can't wait for the sequel. You know, like you see Shao Kahn, you're like, oh, they're gonna fight Shao Kahn, who else is gonna show up from Outworld, etc. The sequel, and I don't want to go into the sequel at all, but the beginning of the sequel, the beginning of the sequel is the same exact scene with, like, I want to say the recap, but guess what? Everybody is played by a different person.
Yeah, they. I think I vaguely remember the beginning. I remember in that movie, because I've tried not to think about it. It's so bad. This is a movie. I don't know if you think this is great or not, but I feel like everyone sort of agrees that if this movie is not considered a great masterpiece, it's still enjoyable and people like it. Mortal Kombat 2, not the case. No love for that movie.
They should have called, instead of Mortal Kombat Annihilation, they should have called it Mortal Kombat 2. No, thank you. it's not the best. It's not, I tried to get through it, actually. Like, I tried to sit through it. Like, I think I saw it when it came out, and I don't really remember it. And there's a good reason for it, probably. And then I remember, like, a couple of months ago, I tried to sit through it, and I watched the beginning, and I was like, everybody's different. It's so weird, you know. Like, they picked up right where they left off, and then just had a cast change, and it was charmless. Like, this movie's very charming, you know.
Yeah, I think that the things I remember from that one, again, it's just like the lack of charm, the wild overacting, the weird recast, and what stands out is they have Jax, and he doesn't have robot arms, but he has like rubber robot things that just go over his arms, and they look, you know, it's like they split the difference, where he didn't lose his arms or get them replaced, he just has robotic covers to give him the strength he needs.
So ridiculous. So. Why Mortal Kombat? What do you think of this movie? What does this movie mean to you?
I mean, I think we touched a lot on the things that I like about this movie. I've always had a soft spot for it, because it does feel like a weird nexus point for all the different pop culture phenomena that was sort of cresting in the 90s. You have action schlock, you have techno music, you have the martial arts craze, and you have the game series itself. You know, we spoke about how Hollywood is trying to tap gaming as a source for material to adapt. And I think that this was one of the more successful attempts. I think it's fitting that Paul W.S. Anderson went on to make the Resident Evil franchise, because at the very least, the first movie is kind of like a spiritual successor to this one, where it's like, it's not super accurate, but it gets the tone right. And it gets feels like a video game. Yeah. It's a job done.
I love that. I think a lot of, by the way.
Yeah, me too. It's certainly on our list. Yeah. I've stopped watching, because I know he's sort of made that that's his living, you know, that's his meal ticket right now. But I think I saw the first two, and the first one was good. And after that, they're like, okay, well, that's your thing now. But as far as this one is concerned, I think a lot of people might want to dismiss it, especially then, because it was a PG-13 rated. And we couldn't get the gory fatalities, but it's like, this movie wasn't, let's be real. Like, who was this movie for? Was it for people who want to see, like a gory horror movie or a gory action movie? It's for the kids who were playing this game and probably like, were quote unquote, like shouldn't have been playing it because we were like too young, but it was then cartoonish violence. And this movie is for that crowd, you know, the kids who are still going to like karate after school and stuff like that. So it's not for the people who are like, no, it needs to be accurate. Someone needs to be cut in half. But like, this is not that movie. That it wasn't that audience. That movie is for the same kids now, because we all grew up.
Right. And I think the remake or whatever it is does a good job of that. You know, there's tons of awesome stuff in there that is completely bananas. I love this flick. I've always loved this flick. I remember, I have very fond memories of seeing it in the theater. I think, you know, you mentioned like the martial arts craze at the time, which I do personally feel like it never went away, you know, because you have your Mortal Kombat, you have your Blades, you have your Matrix, you know, and then you have like your Transporter, your John Wicks, and all of this other stuff. You know, like, I feel like that will always be there, which is cool. You know, when I was a kid, I went to this movie because I loved the game. Again, you're right, I was not expecting to see fatalities. That in as much didn't do it for me as like, whoa, we have a Mortal Kombat game. I'm sorry, we have a Mortal Kombat movie. You know, your expectations are set so low because Hollywood has tried to make these things over and over and over again. And, you know, we're in the same age group, and you remember like the Hulk TV movies.
Yeah,
that's what we had. And that was it. You know, like that was it. So going from like growing up in the 80s and being like, all right, Batman 89 rocked, Batman Returns rocked, and then the other two nonsense movies didn't rock so much. You know, like, we're used to being let down. That being said, Mortal Kombat was not a letdown. And I love this movie. I'll throw it on every so often just to watch it. The soundtrack's awesome. It's so cheesy, but everybody put so much heart and charm into it that it works, you know?
I feel like that's a good thing to highlight. Like, we talked about Kara Tagawa's performance. We talked about Lyndon Ashby doing an amazing job with Johnny Cage, which is like, not really, I don't think he's really, I think he's remembered for this movie. I'm struggling to think of other things he's been in, but I feel like he should get more credit. He's due more credit than he gets for how he sort of made Johnny Cage. If you think about it, like, he's the one who dictates the characterization of Johnny Cage as it continues through the video games.
Right.
You know, Robin Shaw, amazing job. Christopher Lambert chewing up the scenery with his dialogue. Even like, these are, I mean, maybe for the, in some cases, not the best reasons, but they're iconic, you know. Yeah. Like, these are the way that they portray these characters, I think is just so over the top and so fun. That's the charm that this movie has, whereas we were talking about the sequel, like, it does not have that charm. That movie just does not have the same endearing qualities. It's a bummer, and it doesn't have, you know, like, it doesn't have Christopher Lambert. I don't remember if Kara Tagawa was in it, but I feel like all the characters that really gave this movie like the wink and the nod part of it. Maybe the second one would try to be too serious, and this one was like, we're gonna have fun, and that fun attitude has endured, and that's why we still like it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fun top to bottom. It's quick. You know, it's a good, it's what I like to call like a good rock and roll movie. And what I mean by that is get a six pack, get some Mexican food, watch it with a couple of friends, and just point and giggle at the screen.
Yeah. And then you have that song that's going to live on your workout mix for the next couple of decades. And then they remix it every other year. And then you just build up a library of the same song.
That song is going to live forever. That song's going to outlive us.
I was listening to it before we started this.
Just to get you in the mood?
Hell yeah.
Awesome, man. Take us out.
All right. Well, that's going to be it for us. Thanks for joining us. We are your film class heroes, Alex and Rich. And thanks for hanging out. And we'll see you next time.